Those who can, do. Those who cannot, do it on the internet. FancyPantsGangsters.com.
Everybody, and welcome to the Flyover Ska Show, brought to you by MN Ska, the Minnesota Ska community at mnska.com, and of course the Fancy Pants Gangsters podcast network at fancypantsgangsters.com. It's been a while since I've done a remote interview, so I've spent my entire afternoon trying to put together all of the technical pieces, but I think we've got it all figured out. And so we have on the line our special guest today is Mike from the Pinstripes, calling out of Cincinnati, Ohio. Mike, thanks for dropping by.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for getting everything together to arrange for this, Courtney.
Yeah, no problem. What you got cooking? It sounds like the Pinstripes have been quite busy over the past year, and I haven't seen you guys since you guys came up to Minneapolis back in January of last year, I think.
Yeah, so. I think it was pretty much exactly around a year ago.
You know? So what has happened in this year? Can you describe for us?
Sure. Well, we've been really busy just with this record. We have a new record called The Pinstripes Eye, which we've been working really hard on. You know, we had it recorded at that point, but we were still lacking a vision of how we were going to put it together and, you know, what exactly that was going to look like. And so we kind of took our time with that. And since I guess last year, we've played a lot of shows. We went out to the East Coast, and we played all over the Midwest. And then we really kind of buckled down and got serious about this record. We held a Kickstarter campaign to help raise funds to get it produced and, make it the way we want to make it. And now it's finally here, and we're just starting up on a series of release shows and, you know, trying to really spread the word and get people excited about this.
Wow, so. Yeah, it sounds like you guys have really put in a lot of work over this year. And I have to say, you know, ever since I think I first heard of you guys when you guys put together the Midwest Sound Clash split 10 inch with the Green Room Rockers. Right. And so that got me really interested. I was like, wow, who are these guys out of the Midwest of all places? Right. And so then when you guys played in January, a lot of people were pretty blown away. I mean, you guys have a very, I would say it's kind of in the vein of where some of the bands are, but you guys are taking this music in a different direction. Your instrumentation is just, it's unique enough for you guys to really stand out. One of the things that really stood out to me when I saw you guys played the Red Sea, mm-hmm. it was you guys have three horn players, but those horn players are out front, and they all are, it's like the three-part vocal harmony thing.
Right.
So, I mean, and it's really obvious that you guys have burn a lot of calories trying to get those vocal harmonies down just so, and it really pays off.
Thanks, man. It's something that developed over time, and, you know, it's something that, like, I think we always wanted as a band, but we had to really grow. And, you know, like, when we were first writing songs, it's like, I could hear the harmonies in my head, but, like, you know, I had trouble singing them to other people in the band, and then they had trouble remembering the pitches. And it's just kind of like, you know, as we just matured as, like, musicians and kind of got better and figured out, like, how to do it, it's like, finally, we were able to incorporate all these elements that into, you know, our sound that, you know, we had heard and that we had liked so much about other bands. And it's like, finally, I feel like we're at a point where we are a lot more confident and a lot more don't know, we're just a stronger band, and you know, we feel like we can pull off, you know, kind of not whatever we want, but you know, we really have a strong grasp on what we can do. So
right. So for those that don't know, and I'm actually kind of curious too, how did this band kind of start? How did it get its beginnings? Can you take us all the way back?
Yeah, yeah. Well, all the way back would actually be 2003, which is like 8 years ago now.
Yeah.
But yeah, we started it. I mean, it was, you know, we started basically as like a high school ska, kind of ska punk, whatever band. It was Matt and Chris, the bassist and guitar player, with our original drummer, Jared Goldfarb. And it was the three of them and, you know, some other people kind of in a sort of just whatever punk band called Forest Fire. And then Jared, who was my friend from, you know, like from when we were born, basically. I'd known him for a long time. And I had kind of been like slowly like sliding him these ska records, and I had kind of gotten him into ska. He was like, yeah, we're going to try and do some ska stuff. Like, why don't you come and bring your saxophone? And, you know, I knew a trumpet player as Ben, and I was like, well, why don't I, you know, bring him over and we'll see where this goes. And that was kind of the very beginning of it, you know, back in like the fall of 2003. And, you know, we were all like 15, 16 at the time. So it was really... Again, you know, we didn't really know much about like singing harmonies, or let alone like singing like in tune, or you know. but yeah, I mean, we slowly got more serious about it, and we kind of, you know, we're at a point where we have like a really good kind of we have a really solid lineup in terms of, you know, players that are really able to do everything that's asked of them, and we, you know, these aren't simple arrangements. Like, our songs really, you know, demand a lot of each player. And so, yeah, we have a really strong lineup, and we've really kind of grown as a band, and really happy with where we are.
Yeah. So. Well, when you guys were back in the early stages back in 2003, kind of, I always ask the question because I'm very interested in like how even get into this music, and everyone's answer is always different. Why did you guys say, hey, we want to put together some ska related band? What drew you to that music?
Right. Well, to me, it was really funny because like ska, you know, obviously like some of the first bands that I got into were like, you know, the Toasters and, you know, Real Big Fish and, you know, bands like that kind of. And I was just really attracted to it. You know, again, this was, you know, when I was an early teenager and thing. But I was just really attracted to it because it was so different than, you know, the normal music that was getting kind of pushed my way from, you know, whatever mainstream outlet might have been. It was just like, it makes you feel so good, and it's so upbeat, and, you know, it's like, and it just like, it, you know, it hit me that way. So I was originally pulled into that kind of sound, and I think that you know, probably the same for my other band members. Like, you know, obviously maybe they'd name some different bands, but, you know, there's something about that sound that, you know, it was just really attractive. And then, and I was just looking for more bands to listen to. And I've just always been someone who's just kind of like trying to find more new things that, you know, that catch my ear. And I think, yeah, you know, I heard bands like Hepcat, and I heard bands like the Slackers, and, you know, and I was like, this is like kind of like ska, but it's like, it's so sophisticated, and it's so, you know, it's kind of different. Like, what is this about? You know? And I remember actually, the first time that I saw the Slackers, I guess it was in 2002 when they were touring with Flogging Molly, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember this will kind of date it. I don't know if any of you guys remember a website called Audio Galaxy.
I think so. Yeah, I think I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like in between like Napster and like Kazaa.
Right.
It was I got one song of theirs from Audio Galaxy before this show. You know, I had this one song, and it was Sarah.
Oh yeah.
Man, this is like cool. It's like ska, but like swing, and, you know, like again, it's like it has just way more. It's got this just kind of cool New York vibe to it, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And so I was really attracted to that, and then I think from there I went to my record store. I bought a copy of Wasted Days. I went and saw them, and I picked up Better Late Than Never. And then, you know, I started to kind of see like what is this about? And, you know, as a band, we started to see like, where is this coming from? Who are, you know, like, where is the sound coming from? And you find out about the Scatolites. You find out about, you know, like original ska in the 1960s. And you find out about, you know, the Wailers and Bob Marley, that he wasn't just a reggae singer, and that he was, right, in fact, first and foremost, they were like a vocal group during the ska and rocksteady era, you know. And then you find out what is rocksteady, and you find out, you know, like, who are the Ethiopians, who are the Gay Lads, who are the Uniques, like, and it's just this very rich, vibrant history. And, you know, it's really attractive, I think, from an outside point of view, because there's the culture is so deep there, and there's so, you know, the music obviously is so soulful, and so it's held up so well, you know, like, why else would you have, you know, kids in America some like 40, 50 years after the fact finding out about this music and getting really excited about it? You know, there's something about it that just, that has this appeal.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like, yeah, why, I thought about that the other day too. I was like, yeah, why is there such passion for this music, you know, so far away from where it originated, right, so far away time-wise from when it was created. It's like, right, it obviously holds up. It's got a timeless sound to it. And I mean, yeah. I remember, when I was in high school, back in the late 90s and stuff, it was like, I was into the ska punk stuff. I was into, you know, Real Big Fish and Less Than Jake. And I remember going to my first Warped tour in like 2001. And I was like, yeah, this is, I'm all about this, you know, Less Than Jake's here and whatever. And I picked up like this Vans compilation, and I, right, believe it had a Hepcat song on it. And, mm-hmm, it's like, so you got all this, you know, pop punk and hardcore bands and stuff, and then you've got this Hepcat song.
Right.
And it sounds like it's from, like, you know, it sounds like it's really old. I'm like, what is this song doing on here? And then, yeah, I listen to it and I'm like, it's ska, yeah, but it's like old, you, yeah, know. But I was like, no, it's not that old. Yeah. You know, like, so it caused me to pique my interest, and, you know, and I, as you go along, it's like, yeah, it is. It's very, you call it sophisticated. I was almost thinking it was like jazzy. You know, I'm like, wow, this is this. You know, this is for the sort of the older, more hip ska, right, fan, exactly. And I'm like, maybe I want to find out more about this. And
yeah,
I feel, mm-hmm, like, yeah, there's, you know, people get into it in different ways, but there's so much there. There was so much music that was created back in the '60s that you could keep going and down that rabbit hole and never, you know, return. Oh, I guess.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's, you know, I remember, I don't know if it's still around, did you ever know about like that website that they do, that's out of these, I think it's these Brazilian guys, it's like You and Me on a Jamboree?
Oh yeah, I had heard of that.
Yeah, so that, I don't know if it, I haven't been there in a while, but I mean, like, they just like a massive collection of Jamaican music, and they, you know, they had, for a while, they had it up for just free download, and it was just this, it's so much to deal with. There was so many records, and it's like, wow, all of a sudden on demand, I can download like 27 Upsetters records, and I can download like, you know, 32 Scatolites records. And it's like, I didn't even know there was this, you know, mm-hmm, and it's just, it, I mean, you know, it's just so much that you can find, and, you know, and it was a great resource, and I think it, you know, I think they might be still around in some capacity now, but yeah, there's just so much stuff to parse through, and, you know, the more you learn, the more there is to learn.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I'm one of the very first interviews I did when I started this show a couple of years ago, I was talking to Dave Hilliard, and he was saying something about how how far the technology has come to enable you to be able to find some of this music.
Absolutely.
And he was saying, like, someone handed me a thumb drive, and it's like, here is the entire Trojan Records catalog. He's,
yeah,
like, on a 2-inch stick of plastic. You know?
Yeah,
like, is ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I know, you know, people have very mixed opinions about that. You know, some people, especially when you get into like the kind of the vinyl collecting heads and stuff like that, some of them are very much like, there's this whole, I don't know, you know, that's part of the allure of it, is like getting these rare records and, you know, really taking your time to track them down and finding the story behind each album. And when you do have these like massive collections and you can get whatever you want, you know, it's like kind of removes that aspect, and you're just like, all right, I'm just going to exactly. I'm going to get every Trojan comp right now, whatever. I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to do this and not really worry about it.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you could say the perceived value goes down, but I mean, if you really do care and you really want to go through it, the availability is there. And the, you know, if you want to get into the music, what a, what a great way to do it.
Right. Right. And yeah. And I mean, that's, it's not, obviously it's not just with ska, reggae, or rocksteady, or any of that. You know, there's lots of different styles, or, you know, like, you know, music from these kind of early, sort of early or mid 20th century periods that are kind of seeing a resurgence because it's so easy to find, you know, like, you know, Fela Kuti is, you know, and Afrobeat music is another good example, which is like, you know, those records were highly coveted by record collectors and, you know, really hard to find a lot of times. And now, you know, and now he's seen a big resurgence and all these kind of, these kind of like obscure types of world music, I guess, if you want to use like that catch-all phrase. It's like, sure, all the kind of stuff that you can, you know, do a simple Google search and probably be, you know, on your way to downloading it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy world. But the thing is, I kind of wanted to bring it back to you guys here. You talk about like all these different styles of music. You know, as I came across the Pinstripes, as I've, you know, listened to the Midwest Sound Clash, and I saw you guys last year, and now I've listened to the new record.
Right.
I really enjoy it. I mean, it's, I just don't, right now there's not a recent release that sounds like that, you know. And I've noticed that you guys, you know, your sound is, it's not changed, but I would just say it's grown. You want to kind of expand on how it's grown over the past like couple years or so?
Sure. I mean, you know, for us, it's really, you know, it's become, I guess it's sort of been being maybe more deliberate, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, we put a lot of thought into our songs, and, you know, there's a certain aspect of our music that, you know, you could say it's like, all right, we like jam for a while and come up with ideas. But a lot of time it's like, you know, like, all right, like how can we really make these horn parts sound the best? And like, you know, we try different arrangements of playing the same thing. And like, you know, what is the best way that, you know, how can we make this song sound the best? And it, you know, it really is us putting in a lot of work and, you know, trying to just kind of, you know, just really, it's not a, I don't think that most of the stuff with the Pinstripes and the, you know, the growth of our sound is by chance, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, I can't say, you know, explicitly what is, you know, in what ways we've grown specifically over the past couple of years, because, you know, being on the kind of inside of it, it's hard for me. You know, it's like, I think sometimes it's easier for the listeners who, like, they just listen to one record, then they listen to the next one. But it's like, you know, for me, it's like I've been part of it every day. And, you know, it's like sometimes I don't even notice. I, like, you know, I think back, or I'll, like, go find a YouTube video of us playing from even, like, 3 years ago. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe we sounded like that. Or, you know,
exactly. Yeah. It's like when you visit a distant relative that you don't see all that often. They're like, holy crap, you've really grown. And it's like, really? I haven't noticed.
Yes, I did. You know, cool.
I think you know, there are types of bands where you can go see live, and they're fun, but they kind of have that, you know, kind of fuck around attitude. And you guys don't really have that. You have that particularness, that deliberation. You can tell that you guys really are trying to, like, you guys are serious musicians. You're really trying to hone your sound, and you really care. And I think that the fans of your music appreciate that. I've really, like I said, I'm really looking forward to, and for those of you that are listening to this podcast and are in the Twin Cities area, the Pinstripes are coming to Minneapolis, coming to the Red Sea on... was it Saturday, March 3rd? Yeah. So it's coming up in a month and a half or so, and we've got the Prize Fighters on the bill. We've got Dread Eye Dread and Umbrella Bed. So it's going to be an awesome show, and I can't wait to see you guys again. because I do really enjoy what you guys do. I feel like you guys have kind of gone in the direction of sort of, there's a lot more dub, there's a lot more like kind of free flow to it, and like a little more roots influence. Instrumentation wise, I've noticed, you know, not only do you play saxophone, but you play flute and melodica and these different sorts of, you know, introducing these different sorts of instruments into the music. Did those come about just because you're playing around with them, or did you really want to incorporate those elements for a certain reason, or?
That's a good question. I think it's kind of a mix of things. So, you know, like the melodica, obviously, you know, if you get into like roots reggae, you know, it has deep roots in that sound. And, you know, with people like Augustus Pablo, who really, you know, made that an important staple in a lot of dub records and a lot of roots reggae records. And, you know, so we were, you know, big fans of that. And I guess, you know, the first song of ours that had melodica in it is partly because there's a song called One Drop, and I wrote the beginnings of that song when I was like studying abroad, actually, and I was in Israel, and I had like no band to play with. I had no other instruments with me other than this little melodica, and so I had no other musical outlet. So I came up with this part, you know, on this melodica, and so it was simply kind of out of like necessity that I came up with that. And when we came back, we like worked it in because, again, I was just like, hey, I have this idea. And then, with flute, flute is actually the first instrument that I took lessons on. It's where I pretty much got most of my fundamentals on music. And, you know, I took lessons on it for, gosh, probably like 10 or 11 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, you know, it never, like, especially when we were starting off and we were more of this kind of like ska rock kind of thing, it just had no place in that. But since we've kind of, you know, we've have some more groovy tempos and some more, like, you know, space and room for to add different textures, it, you know, we just tried it out and we liked the way it sound, and right. I think that sort of, you know, describes how we've kind of came to incorporate other different things too. It's like we just, you know, we had room for it and we liked the way it sounded. And now the three of us, Chris, Leo, and I, we all actually live in a house together in Cincinnati, and we have this, you know, this big room in our house. It's just a practice space. It's where we play. We've, you know, done some brief demo recording there, and, you know, we just, you know, that's where a lot of stuff goes down. And we just have a ton of instruments lying around there. You know, we have, mm-hmm. like hand drums and, you know, tambourines and obviously bass drums, guitar and all this stuff, and, you know, an organ and all this stuff. So it's kind of there for us to just, you know, mess around with and see, you know, what we can come up with.
And take this in the spirit in which is intended. So you started off on the flute. What caused you to pick up the flute in the first place? I mean, I know when people think a guy playing a flute, they're thinking Pussy Magnet, right? But and
well, all right. So you have to go back. Like I think I want to say I was like 5 or 6 years old when I started. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents basically made me pick an instrument. They're like, you know, you can play whatever you want, but you have to, like, by the time you're whatever you're, I think I was 5, maybe 6. You know, when you get this age, you need to pick an instrument. And, you know, in my, you know, 5.5-year-old self, I was like, well, I like that one that's like, you know, shiny and it's got a lot of buttons, you know. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I was like, I want to do that one, and I want to play something else that like no one else in our family plays, because we have like a musical family. My brother is a drummer, my dad, you know, sings and plays a little bit of piano, and my mom can play piano and guitar and other stuff. And so, you know, my 5-year-old self, I just wanted, you know, this shiny thing with buttons. So that's why I wound up with flute, you know.
That is interesting. Having a family with that places emphasis on music, I think it's interesting that you really put yourself into music. Sometimes I think a lot of times kids like to rebel with,
right.
You know, try to get a push away from something that's put upon them by their parents. So
right.
I'm really, it's interesting that you kind of went along with it so far and here you are now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, yeah. And it is interesting because I think for a while I was just kind of like, this is, you know, I'm just doing this because I have to. And I, you know, I can remember practicing and going to lessons when my other friends were, you know, like out, whatever, like playing neighborhood football. And, you know, I did some of that, but there sometimes I was like, man, I wish I didn't have to do my, like my scales and whatever, you know, but, yeah. And I, you know, but you know, now I'm just so grateful and so glad because it gave me that foundation and it really, you know, it gives you a discipline, a certain discipline that I think is really important and necessary for just, you know, bettering yourself really as a musician. But honestly, you can kind of translate it to kind of anything really, you know, to help you grow and to help you learn a skill or anything, you know, to get that discipline to practice something over and over and, you know.
Absolutely. It's, yeah, I don't usually, you know, judge too many people, but I mean, it's like even if you're in that discipline, if you're in organized sports, or
right.
if you're in something where it's like, you need to, you know, put in hard work, put in practice, put in that time, to kind of hone whatever skill it is, be it musical or athletic. And
right.
it's like those people end up, you know, becoming hard workers and, you know, applying themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very, like I said, it's very transferable. You know, it's like, if you can make that connection, it's like, you know, okay, well, like that can help you just as a general kind of like personal trait in life.
Right. I wanted to talk to you about, making this album, since this is your guys' debut album. You guys have been around for 8 years, and it's like you said, your style has changed drastically, I guess, over time as you guys grew as musicians.
Right.
And now this is the point where you guys want to release your first full length. What went into that process?
Sure. Well, first to clarify, it's actually not our first full length, although it does feel like it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but if you pick up any of our other full length, it will feel like, you know, this is a new band. Our first one was actually in 2006, I want to say.
Okay.
And we had a girl singer at the time, you know, it's very like, you know, maybe Save Ferris or something, like No Doubt or something. And so this is actually our third full length. But again, very much, I think, feels like our first full length because it is, you know, our first as a really kind of, we had a very solid foundation here. And it's like, we really feel like we've built this to a point that we're really proud of. And, you know, and while these other records, it's like, I kind of like, there's some moments that I like, a lot of times I'll like look back and like wince at like this one. I think that I will pretty much like always be proud of this record.
Yeah. Well, you guys definitely put a lot of thought and a lot of work into it. So right. it better be something that you're proud of.
Yeah. Yeah. So now to answer the question, for this record, you know, some of these songs we have had for, a while now, like that song One Drop, which turns up on this new record. Like I said, I wrote while I was abroad in college, which was like the end of 2007. And then early 2008 is when we like first started playing the song. So that's, you know, like 4 years ago, I guess. That's like the oldest song on there. And then some of them were written like right before we went up and recorded. But the record was recorded in Chicago, at Dirty North Studios, which is the home of Anthony Abinanti, of the Drastics and of Deals Gone Bad, mm-hmm. who I think you've had on your show, right?
Yeah, yeah, he's a former guest on the show. Yeah, he was. How did you get involved with Anthony?
Well, you know, so I went to school up in Chicago for college. I went to DePaul, and you know, I think it was maybe a month or two that I was up there before I caught wind of the Drastics. And I was going to go try to see the Rebirth Brass Band, which is like a great New Orleans style brass band. And there happened to be a dub reggae band opening. And I was like, this sounds like the coolest show ever, like a New Orleans brass band with a dub reggae band opening. And I couldn't make it because it was 21 and up. And I was like 18 at the time. You know, I just started my freshman year. And but I, you know, I was like, all right, I need to find out what this band is about. And, you know, so I went to see them. I saw them a bunch of times while I was up there. And so, you know, I got really, you know, I was very into their music, and I, you know, showed it to the to my band. And we were able to play with the Drastics once or twice. And then, you know, we played with Deals, and, you know, I like, you know, Anthony is just kind of around in the Chicago reggae and ska scene, sort of.
Right.
And, you know, I knew he had his own studio. And so when we were making plans to record this album, you know, we talked about how cool it would be if that was like a real possibility, if we could do it with Anthony. And so we reached out to him, and, you know, fortunately he was like, you know, he was interested in the idea, and he was willing to have us come up and record it at his place. And so we went up there, and this was in the summer of 2010. We went up there, and we actually basically stayed at his, he lived at a coach house at the time. We stayed at his coach house, which is where the studio was. And, you know, we just lived there for like 10 days and, you know, recorded like, you know, 10, 11 hours a day. And that's, you know, when the bulk of the record was laid down.
Wow. So. Yeah. That, I mean, that sounds like sort of an interesting time. And I mean, you hear about some bands, they'll record little bits over time, and some right. will, you know, like you guys did, you know, hole yourself up and kind of in, like, move in for a short time and just get it all down, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. For us, actually, it was funny. That was kind of like the only option we had, because we had members who were getting ready to like be gone for a long time, actually. And Matt, our guitar player, like moved to San Francisco, like right after we recorded it. So, you know, it was like the only option we had to like get this done. And we didn't, you know, we did almost everything. We went up there like two more times, maybe just to do like some percussion and, you know, finish up some vocals and stuff. But for the most part, it was all laid down in this 10-day period. And it was mostly out of necessity, because we had to do it in this time frame.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, that was kind of our only shot.
Well, and, you know, the last time I talked to Anthony when he was on the show, he had mentioned that he was working on your guys' album, and he's like, these guys are the real deal, man. Like, he was really, really pumped for this album. And that was a long time ago that I actually talked to him. So it was like, this, I knew that you guys, I mean, this album has been long in the making.
Right.
And so for those that don't know, it's coming out February 3rd, I think, is the actual release date.
Yeah. This Friday, right?
Yeah. So it's coming out this Friday, and, I guess, where can people kind of pick up or get the album if they want it?
Sure. The Pinstripes Eye release date, February 3rd. We will have it available online at various locations. We're working with Whatevsky Records, which is kind of like the Slackers associated label. We'll have it up on other, you know, like iTunes and Rhapsody and all these other online retailers. We have our own online store that you can find through thepinstripes.net, or actually it's through Big Cartel. So if you go to thepinstripes.bigcartel.com, you can order all the physical stuff. You can get the LP, you can get the CD.
Yeah, the physical stuff looks amazing, because I mean, from what I've watched and seen what you guys have released over time here, you guys have said that, I mean, looks like everything is very much handcrafted, and I mean, it looks like you guys spent a lot of time on the creative packaging of this album.
Yeah, I mean, we happen to have some guys in the band who, you know, who really are deeply invested in that stuff, and also happen to be really, like, just amazingly talented at it, you know. Matt, our guitar player, is a graphic designer, and Chris, our bass player, he's just a very, he's like a very hands-on kind of guy. And they were just kind of up for the challenge of really diving headfirst into this. And, you know, everyone's helped out along the way. And, you know, they had a vision, and, you know, we were able to make that vision a reality. And part of that is in thanks to, you know, people like you, Courtney, who helped us when we did our Kickstarter campaign and donated to that, and helped us so that we could make this, you know, such a cool product that hopefully everyone will appreciate.
And, well, it's easy to invest in something like that when I see you guys, I hear your music, I see you guys live, and I'm just impressed. And then I hear, you know, people like Anthony shouting your praises, and I'm like, I think there's something to this band. I want to help in any way I can.
Yeah, we really, really appreciate that. We're just so grateful that, you know, people responded that way. Cause when we did do the Kickstarter campaign, it was, I don't want to say it was a big risk, but it was just like, we had no idea what was going to happen. And, you know, to get the response that we did was just really, really, a big moment for us and very encouraging. And, you know, being that we did record this album so long ago, and you know, we've been hearing it for so long, it's like, you know, there are times where it's like, okay, you know, we're just like, yeah, we have this thing, we need to get it out. And it's like, sometimes you just get like, you know, not down on it, but just you're not as excited as you want to be. And then, you know, having this happen was like this big, just like, you know, shot in the arm. And we were just like, all right, yes, like finally this is going to happen. We're going to do it. And like, you know, when we sort of reached our mark for the Kickstarter campaign, it was like, okay, like now it's on us to like, you know, step up and
bring the goods. Yeah.
Do everything that we just promised all these people we were going to do. And like really just, you know, sort of lit a fire under our ass to use the expression. And I think that it turned out really well. So hopefully everyone else, you know, and all the fans, can appreciate that.
What do you think was kind of a the reason for the success, or what do you think attributed to the success of the Kickstarter campaign? Because a lot of bands, I think, are trying to use a Kickstarter as a way to be able to put out their own music.
Right.
So what do you think worked for you guys?
Man, you know, it's in some ways, like I can point to a few things, you know. But like honestly, I don't know for sure, and like we didn't know if it was gonna work. You know, it was just like a thing that we just thought we'd give it our best shot. But we really did kind of study what works and what doesn't before we put it up. We looked at a lot of other Kickstarter campaigns, and we did just some of our own research in terms of like best practices and like, you know, what people are doing that's working and what people are doing that's not working. And, you know, how to set up your rewards and how to make them realistic and how to make them, you know, valuable for potential backers. And, you know, just like how we, you know, like I said, like as with our music, it was a very deliberate thing. And it wasn't just like, all right, we'll do this and we'll just throw it up and, you know, take time and make a video that explains what you're talking about and shows, you know, and gives people a look into, you know, what your project is. And yeah, and like you said, you know, be for real, be serious, like don't half acid if you're gonna, you know.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, if you're serious about it, other people will also, you know, appreciate the time that you're taking to make this a success. I'm new to the Kickstarter thing, but I gotta say, you know, if you're a ska band that's out there and you've proven that you can, that you're talented, and you're proven that you can, you know, put out great music and are serious about it and are going to, you know, make the overall American ska music scene a success, I'm going to do what I can to back you. I feel like there are many people out there that feel the same way. And like, clearly with this successful Kickstarter campaign, there are quite a few.
Right. And yeah. And I mean, to be honest, like I think that with the Kickstarter thing, I think it's, you know, you can kind of take that statement and kind of take it more on a broad scale. And I think that there's just people out there who really, you know, like they really are into supporting the arts in general and supporting, you know, creative people with a vision who are driven. And that Kickstarter really opened our whole band, it really opened our eyes to that like there's this whole online community of people who are doing really interesting things and who are making their sort of their dreams happen because they, you know, they're taking them seriously and they're connecting directly with people who want to help make that happen and want to be, you know, kind of in at the ground level in terms of investing and just, you know, just helping be a part of making that vision come true.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of examples where, like, I think there's a guy that made this iPod dock, and all it was he took like this piece of steel, and so he just made it. He basically just made the iPod dock or the iPhone dock like very heavy, so that you could just put it down and put your iPhone down and pick it up without. Without the charger going along with it, and and it seemed like such an innocent or sort of a small endeavor, right. And like I think he set like a very modest goal, and he had like $300,000 worth of backing, and it's like wow, people can do stuff like that, and it's not just musicians out there. There's all sorts of creative minds that are kind of using Kickstarter to their advantage.
Yeah, totally. Actually, one interesting stat that I heard from someone, obviously I can't, qualify this, but I was told that so the National Endowment for the Arts nationwide in the U.S. is $150 million a year. And then I was heard that last year on Kickstarter alone, there was $120 million of funds raised.
Oh.
This year, it's going to surpass that. It's going to surpass the mark of the National Endowment for the Arts. And it's this really, and this is kind of, again, just getting, this is sort of zooming out past like the pinstripes or anything that we're talking about. But it's an interesting thing because, a lot of people in nonprofit and all this stuff think that that arts funding is going down and that people don't want to give anymore because, it's a tough time for the economy. But I think that a thing like Kickstarter shows that it's like people really do want to connect with these projects, and people really are still excited to give to things, to artistic projects that they believe in. But, they're looking for new ways to connect. And I think that this is like Kickstarter is a really great way to do it. So,
it totally is. It's a way more direct. And that's how I've always felt comfortable kind of contributing. So whether it's, just if I'm going to buy like music, I don't like going to iTunes and buying music. I like going to a show and like handing the band my money, and saying, hey, I appreciate what you're doing, and if I get, a CD or a t-shirt or vinyl or whatever it is, whatever merch it is, they're seeing the direct benefit. And right. I feel like Kickstarter is a way for that to also happen, where it's not just a, hey, I am giving you this money for this product. It's like, hey, I am giving you money because I support what it is that you're doing.
Right. Yeah. And I, that's what I'm saying. I think people really respond to that kind of form of support, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Now turning to kind of the American ska scene itself, because I've seen, like I mentioned, if there are bands out there that, that are, looking for, looking to make their mark on the scene, I'd love to get in touch with them and support them. But you've played all these tours, and you've played with many different bands, and you cite a lot of different influences and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Do you have? I feel like you might have a good grasp on like where ska and reggae music is on sort of more of a national scene. What trends have you seen? What things have you noticed? Where do you think kind of the state of the ska union is?
Right. Well, so it's interesting because I'm not about to say that I think that there's going to be like this fourth wave or some kind of like epic resurgence that that other people might claim. I don't know if something like that will happen. But on the other hand, it is interesting. Once you are a band, kind of looking to open yourself up to on a national level, or just bigger than your little your city or your maybe just your state, when you open yourself up to that, and you're from our perspective, we go out of town and we look for bands kind of to play with that we dig and that maybe have a similar sound. And it is interesting how many cities you can go to that have like bands that play rock steady or whatever, in America, that are playing like we said earlier, that are playing like stuff inspired by things that happened like 50, 60, 40 years ago in this little tiny island,
Right.
And so I think that it is an interesting sort of fact, I guess, of the scene that there are a lot of these bands. And, you know, I still think that it's going to stay, you know, a underground kind of thing, just because that's where it's at. But, you know, I think that still offers something for a lot of people. And, you know, it might not spread to everyone that might like it. You know, there might be some people who, you know, who would dig that kind of thing, but maybe, you know, because it's not publicized in the avenues that they find out about music, you know, that maybe it won't spread as big as, like, you know, certain other styles that are huge right now. But I do think that it really is very focused on the people who really dig it right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a subculture. So those that are that enjoy the music probably are going to find it in some way. And to go back and talk about your, like, finding those little pockets or those places where people are playing the music or digging the music, is a perfect example. This past year, I've been playing with the Prize Fighters, and we got these offers down in Des Moines to play these shows. Now, right. Des Moines, Iowa is just kind of in the middle of nowhere. The only reason why people even care is, like, for political primaries and caucuses and stuff. But, like,
right. And even that's just for, like, there's like a month of hype and then everyone forgets
right,
about it.
Exactly. And so it's interesting because we go down there and there's this whole crew of people that are into that subculture, you know, like the skinhead reggae sort of stuff. I mean, and they're not just there to be, you know, to look cool. They're there because they really dig it. And, like, so they brought up this band, the Bishops, from Omaha. And mm-hmm. So they come and play. And then they've brought us, the Prize Fighters, and then a couple bands from our area, like Blue Waffle or the Drop Steppers, and they bring them down, and, you know, we make the 4-hour drive down there, but it's so worth it because there's a huge crowd of people that dig it. And so it's right. Like, if this exists in Des Moines, Iowa, and there's, like, no bands from Des Moines, Iowa that we know of, they just sure. pull these bands from, you know, 2 or 4 hours out and bring them in. And right. It's like, it's so cool to be able to play to them instead of going, you know, and maybe playing, you know, a big market, like, you know, maybe heading to the West Coast or heading to even Chicago. You know, if you're going to, it may be hit or miss. Like, we played in Milwaukee and it was like a miss because we just didn't, you know, we thought that there was, the subculture there.
Right.
And it wasn't there in the way that, you know, we see it in the Twin Cities or we've seen it now in Des Moines. So it's like, maybe it's just kind of like finding what sticks and going right. around. Have you guys run into similar situations? You know, like, where right. on tour have you guys really found success?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, like, you look at a band and just look at a band like Green Room Rockers, you know, like Lafayette, Indiana is a pretty, you know, interesting place for a band like that to pop up.
It's a college town. I mean, that's Purdue, right? I think
that's West Lafayette. They're like in Lafayette, which is just like a town. I mean, obviously yeah. they kind of formed through meeting at Purdue, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, there are, you know, and we've been fortunate to be able to play with them in Lafayette and even do a couple of our own headlining shows there. And yeah, and people, you know, really dig it. And I have to, like, step back and say that we really, I mean, as much as, like, the ska reggae scene is, like, really where we come from and it's our roots and what we love, you know, we're kind of trying to just play for people that really just dig good music. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're not, while we do want to find bands that we can fit on a bill with and that, you know, we can kind of understand each other. We're, like I said, we're honestly just looking for audiences that are open to having a good time because, you know, we really feel like as a band that are hopefully that when we play live that it comes across, you know, that the people get it regardless of if they have ever heard of Rocksteady or if they know what a one drop beat is or, you know, like any of this stuff, like, you know.
You don't, yeah, that's the beauty of your guys' music is you really don't need to be, you know, a an expert in that area of music to enjoy it. You know, like you guys could probably play, you know, any sort of festival or any sort of show, no matter what music fan is in the audience, no matter what age of, you know, a concert goer.
Right. And that's,
you guys have a wide appeal.
And that's the hope. And yeah, and I mean, and our Cincinnati shows, honestly, that's how it is. It's not really, I mean, we have big shows, but it's not really like, you know, like 400 ska fans sitting there, like all, you know, all super stoked because we just played this, you know, ska song or whatever. It's just this wide group of people. And, you know, some of them, you know exactly like these styles that we're drawing from. And some of them are just there because they really dig it. And it is, it's people of all ages. You know, we have like moms that come out and just like none of our moms are just like these moms that just come out and like get dolled up and just like dance the whole time. And we have, you know, underage kids and we have kids our age and are in college and are like, you know, or in their 20s or 30s. And that's really what we're trying to go for is just, you know, to get people who want to come out and have a good time and, you know, and hopefully that, you know, there's enough there that any, you know, like, we try to make music that is, you know, sort of maybe like sort of pop informed so that, you know, even if you, again, if you've never listened to, you know, a Rocksteady record or a ska record, it's like you can appreciate like a good hook, or you can appreciate like, you know, a nice melody, or like you said, you know, like the good vocal harmonies, you know, there's something about it, or like, you know, maybe some people really get excited about a horn section, you know, there's something there that you can latch onto regardless of where you're coming from, you know?
Right, exactly. You know, I've noticed there's like a big or a group that's getting bigger of bands coming from the Midwest that are just really impressing me, and they're really, I mean, whether it's, you know, the Pinstripes, Green Room Rockers, you keep coming over, you know, Deal's Gone Bad, or the Crombies now, their two-tone project. You've got, you know, we got stuff cooking up here in the Twin Cities, the Bishops down in Nebraska. You've got various bands from Michigan. There's a lot of talent going on. And I feel like, you know what I mean? Like there's all these pieces.
Sure.
I feel like there's got to be a way to put those pieces together and maybe sort of, and I'm not saying put on like a ska fest or something, but I'm just, I want, because I would like the whole country to realize this seemingly like kind of hotbed of bands that are coming up.
And right, yeah.
I mean, they're similarly minded, you know?
Yeah, I think that was sort of, you know, what, like, you know, when, you know, us and the Green Room Rockers, when we had that whole idea for like Midwest Sound Clash, it was a fun thing where we were kind of coming up at the same time. And, you know, obviously we really enjoyed playing with each other, and, you know, we really wanted to kind of spread that awareness of like, hey, here's these two bands from like Indiana and Ohio, where if you go to the East Coast or the West Coast, like they don't even know where that is probably,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, you know, people in like New York, no offense, I love New York, but like I've had people be like, oh, is that, that's next to like, you know, like Omaha, right? You know, it's like, oh, but it's over the, you know, like it's all the same, but, you know, so it's like, yeah, we need to big up the Midwest and like, you know, have people like understand what's going on out here. And, you know, I mean, there's some people who've really, you know, made some moves to try to, you know, raise the level of the scene on a whole. And, you know, Mark Cooper, I think, is definitely one of those people from Green Room Rockers. Mm-hmm. Dave Kay of Mustard Plug has really been supportive of us and of other, you know, bands in the Midwest here.
Right.
And then, you know, expanding out of the Midwest, you know, there's obviously bands like the Fourth Rights that we're good buddies with over on the East Coast. And that, you know, we've, you know, had all these discussions of like, you know, like touring together and just kind of like how to raise the awareness and raise the level of just kind of this new, you know, batch of bands that are doing this stuff, I guess.
Yeah. It's like, I feel like if we could just all put our, you know, ska reggae minds together, you know, in the Midwest. We can come up with something, you know, I don't even know what format it would take, whether it would be a tour, a fest, a compilation, a release, some sort of way where we can kind of all come together and be like, you know, check us out. Like, this is, right. this is, you know, this is what you will get, you know, by coming through the Midwest. And that's kind of the reason I put together this podcast a couple years ago. It's like the Flyover Ska Show. It's talking about the flyover country, all these states that nobody really seems to know anything about. You know?
Yeah, and, no, and it's great. I'm really, you know, it's like, every time I am fortunate enough to get to do one of these kinds of interviews, I always try to make sure to, you know, thank you, Courtney, thank the people who are hosting it, because it's like, it's this kind of stuff that really helps build it up and make it into a kind of thing that people can get excited about. And, you know, people can find out more about, you know, because us bands, sometimes we're, you know, so busy writing our songs and playing our shows that we don't have time to, like, you know, we don't have time to think about.
What the fuck you
doing,
man?
It's Leo.
Hey.
Fuck you.
What's up, Leo?
That's Leo. He's I'm in his room doing this interview.
Get off my computer. All right, I'm done.
That's the rant. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's cool that you guys do this kind of stuff and, you know, make this a really worthwhile thing for people to check out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, Mike. And just to reiterate, the album, The Pinstripes Eye, is dropping on Friday, February 3rd. You can pick it up online. Is it Price Fighter? Pinstripes.net. Sorry.
Yeah, it's all good.
Pinstripes.net and or pinstripes.bigcartel.com. You can pick that stuff up online. I highly recommend checking out their physical release stuff. You can go online and check out, you know, what it is. You guys went into great detail putting that stuff together. There's tons of liner notes. There's tons of stuff that you get. These guys actually give a shit about what they, what you release. Also, in the Twin Cities area to represent, you guys are going on a big tour to release this album, and it's going all over the place. It's going to end up in Minneapolis at the Red Sea on Saturday, March 3rd. With the Prize Fighters, Dread Eye Dread, and Umbrella Bed. It's an all-ages show, and it's gonna be amazing. And hopefully it's going to be a little bit warmer than the last time you guys came up. I believe it was like sub-zero when you guys were here. God.
Dude, I remember from the last time I went, you know, I had to park our van, and we parked it in that parking lot around the corner, just behind it. I remember I was just trying to, like, stick this dollar bill in the machine, and I had my gloves on, and I just couldn't do it. I took my gloves off for, like, 20 seconds to put this dollar bill in, and my hand was just like immediately blue, and I couldn't feel it for like, you know,
guys, Minnesota winters. I mean, that'll do it to you.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot, Mike. I've been your host, Courtney Close, and for Mike and all of the Pinstripes, and we're saying skank on.
I was caught by the way she moved, and now I'm hanging on to every last breath. So when she asks, can I have this dance? Well, how the hell can I say anything but yes? Well, I've seen her type before. She got all the right weaponry, but I swore I would hang no more. All this girl could be the death of me. Cause when she smiles,
when she smiles,
trying to keep my cool.